After 4 decades as a reporter, Leslie Stahl's most vivid and transformative experience of her life was not covering the White House, interviewing heads of state, or researching stories at 60 Minutes. It was becoming a grandmother. She was hit with a jolt of joy so intense and unexpected, she wanted to investigate it, as she would any news story. And so, using her journalistic skills, she explored how grandmothering changes a woman's life, interviewing friends like Whoopi Goldberg and colleagues like Diane Sawyer, and even grandfathers like Tom Brokaw. Along with these personal accounts, she speaks with scientists and doctors about psychological and physiological changes that occur when they have grandchildren, anthropologists about why there are grandmothers in evolutionary terms, and psychiatrists about the therapeutic effects of grandchildren on both grandmothers and grandfathers. Her new book is Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting. This year marks her 25th season on CBS's 60 Minutes, and it is a great honor to welcome Leslie Stahl to the roundtable. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm going to geek out for a moment, but I'm so thrilled to meet you.
Oh, Joe.
Just like that journalistic gold standard, and to have you right there is
here's
pretty
a secret,
cool for
Joe.
Me.
Joe, here's my secret.
Okay.
Lasting. Just lasting.
Did you think about that at the beginning of what it took to last?
I did. I've always wanted to survive because you know why? I love it. And so I wanted to keep doing it. And I'm still doing it.
So let me bring it back to the book. Does grandparenting get in the way of doing the job?
No, it doesn't. I have a great job. And one of the benefits is that we get to choose our own stories. Of course, the boss has to okay them, and it has to come in under budget. But we basically get to choose our own stories. And we have teams, and my team knows that if anybody proposes a story in Los Angeles, where my grandchildren are, I'll say yes, even if I don't like the story. I'm there. So I've been doing a lot of stories on the West Coast lately.
There's even a, you even have a line in the book that this feeling of being away and going and spending time with the grandchildren that you almost feel like you're cheating on CBS a little bit.
Yeah, but you know I had since the first one was born, there are now 2 grandchildren. I've had complete seasons, and meaning I've fulfilled my obligation and then some. So it really hasn't. No.
So what struck you to want to write about it? To investigate it?
Well, the publisher of Blue Rider Press asked me to write a book about 60 Minutes. And I looked at him, we were having lunch, I looked at him and I said, you know, are you serious? If I write the truth about 60 Minutes, the warts, you know, and all, mm-hmm. I'm out of there and I'm not ready to leave, but I don't think I would survive that. And if I don't tell the warts and all, it would be boring. So I'm not going to write about that. That's off the table. So then we just had lunch. And of course, I'm a boring grandmother. I talked about my granddaughter. I just had one at that point. I mean, driving him probably crazy. At the end of lunch, he said, I think that's your book, writing about being a grandmother. And I didn't think it was right away. But when I sat with it and thought about it, I realized that it wouldn't just be my story. I had a lot of girlfriends who were step-grandmothers, and I knew I'd write about that. I actually called a biochemist who had written a book saying that a mother is completely rewired when she becomes a mother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, hormonally and the neurons in her brain change. And I asked her on the telephone if the same thing or anything similar happens to a grandmother. She said yes. So then I knew I had a book because I could write about the science. And I could write about different kinds of grandmothers. And the other thing I realized early on was that mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law have, an inevitable clash. And that would be another chapter. So it evolved, and then I was really excited to write the book. I loved writing the book.
Your oldest grandchild is 5 years old, Jordan.
Jordan.
And you write about it, but talk about that experience of having that child in your arms for the first time?
Well, everybody always says the best thing that ever happens to a woman is to become a grandmother. But you can't imagine why they say that until it happens to you. Because the emotions, the feelings are full body, they're deep, and they're unlike anything. It was like a truck with those big giant wheels, giant huge wheels just rumbling through you. Huge, enormous. And that's the beginning. And it stays with you, that attachment. Mm. And what the biochemist told me was that we are being rewired and we are secreting a bonding hormone that physically binds us to those babies.
We're not, you say, used to being hugged.
Oh, yeah, so that was my epiphany.
That idea of having that child in the center of your chest.
Yeah. I mean, think about who we hug once we grow up.
Right.
We do the air kiss. We do the man thing, you know.
The fist bump.
The fist bump and the real fast little huggy thing. And we're out of there. And we all have space. We have our little protection around us. So all of a sudden, you have another body pressed up against the middle of you, your heart, all the organs, right down the center. Oh, my gosh, you realize we were meant to hug. And, of course, we love these babies so much. So you're not only just hugging. You're hugging the thing that means more to you than anything. And so that those physical feelings last.
You write in the book about just the relationship, and you mentioned it a moment ago, but that relationship between yourself and the parents of that child. And several times throughout the book, you use terms like walking on eggshells and dicey, and it can be quite a dance, can it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Here you've been the parent for years and years. And all of a sudden, the balance of power shifts in the family where your child has a key, meaning they control access to the thing, as I just said, that you want more than anything in the world, which is to hold that child or to be in that child's presence, to become part of that baby's life. And you suck up to your kid that you haven't done ever before. And it's one thing when it's your own daughter. It's another thing when it's your daughter-in-law and the inevitable tension that already exists in that relationship. And now you have to, as a psychiatrist told me, you're the supplicant. And you are, even if you never say it out loud, begging them to give you time with the babies. And, you know, if you're a nag, if you're critical, forget it. They're going to resent it. So, you know, bite your tongue. That's the answer.
And you write about those grandparents who are begging to see those children, and because the parents have that power, are said, I'm not going to subject you to that person and what I dealt with growing up.
Right, right. And that's the most painful part of grandparenting that I discovered. Grandparents who are denied access to their own grandchildren. I find it close to immoral to deny a grandparent time with their grandchild. Unless, of course, the grandparent is a known abuser. But short of that, the way people parent and the way they grandparent are so different. And this is universal. Grandparents are softies. You know, we look at those children and we just melt. And so to say, oh, she was strict with me, or she was too critical, or, you know, she's no fun, whatever it is, she's different as a grandmother. She's loving as a grandmother. She can't help, she doesn't even know what's happening to her herself.
You have a line in the book that growing up without a grandmother is not healthy for children. So two parts of the question, and one is, why is that? Why? What do we know about that healthiness that grandparents give children?
Okay, now we get into the rest of the science, as in the title.
Yes.
Because in historical terms, grandmothers babysat. It wasn't only the males that hunted. Females hunted, the young females, the mothers. And they went off to get food for the rest of the family while the grandmother stayed home and raised the children. So it is in our genetic makeup to do that. That's why grandmothers survive after menopause. You look at most animals, they die when the female can no longer reproduce. Mm. That's the end of it. But not humans. And the reason is because we were taking care of the babies and allowed the tribe to thrive. And so it's within the whole makeup of our species. We are meant to babysit grandmothers, and when we don't, we crave it. And grandchildren are meant to have that kind of love, which is an unconditional love, from their grandparents, from their grandmothers and grandfathers, both. And when they don't have that, there's a missing piece.
And the just because of the nature of the relationships, you write about Whoopi Goldberg, who became a grandparent very young.
Really young.
Whereas you were in your 60s.
Yeah. Yeah, and so ripe and ready. You
know? That's quite a span.
Well, I think if you're a very young grandparent, men and women, it's frightening because you're young. And all of a sudden you're grandma and you have the sense of your own grandparents in your head and society's sense of grandparenthood. And it's that image is of a little old lady with gray permed hair and really thick glasses who plays canasta all day long and bakes cookies. And of course, the people who are becoming grandparents in droves today are baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And there are no little old ladies sitting around baking cookies. We're just not doing it. We're out being reporters or doctors or lawyers or whatever. So that image is way off. And nevertheless, it still exists in people's minds. So if you're 40 or 50, you're going to be called grandma. It's a little scary at first. And then, of course, the baby's born, and that just goes all away the minute they, whatever age you are, you see a grandchild. If you're in your 60s, now you're worried you're not going to be a grandparent. Right. And you get to be so grateful. You know, call me anything you want. I don't care. Ask for as much money as you want. I'm giving it, whatever. Because now you're just relieved, as I was.
I don't have children, but of course, I knew both my grandfathers passed before I was born. I was the youngest of five kids, so my parents were older when they had me. So I only had about 6 or 7 years with my grandmothers before they passed, mm-hmm. which I guess that's another part of the equation, the time that we have and making that as special as it can be.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, if your grandparents die, there's nothing you can do about it. I was just in the book when I wrote that line about how essential it is to have grandparents. I was really at the point in the book where I'm lecturing parents not to keep their parents away. No matter how difficult the relation is between the two of you, don't deprive your child of the grandparent.
You issue a call to arms at the end of the book.
It's I do.
Become more involved.
Become more involved. It's a win-win-win because today young parents are both working, inevitably. They're both working and probably not earning as much money as my generation did at the same age because of the economy. Child care is just out of the question for a lot of families. It takes up a full salary. In many, many households, a full salary just to afford decent child care. So along comes grandma. She not only is available to babysit, she's dying to babysit. And she doesn't charge you anything. She'd pay you, actually, to let her babysit. So the parents need the help. The babies need us. And the grandparents benefit in every which way, not the least of which is mentally, there are studies that show it fends off dementia. It is therapeutic in that it can lift depression. I mean, there are all kinds of studies that show this. And it's a healthy thing for a grandparent to watch their little one grow up and to participate in their life, to be in their life. It's good for everybody.
And then, Leslie.
Yeah. Here it comes.
There are the other grandparents.
Yeah, then there are the OGs, the other grandparents. And I discovered myself, but also in interviewing around, that there is a built-in competition, that nobody wants to admit even to themselves, but there it creeps up, you know, does the baby prefer them to us? And if so, why? And my daughter told me the other day that Jordan and Chloe's, my granddaughter's other grandparents, have more energy than we do. They're younger. And I was devastated. I didn't know I didn't have all the energy in the world. I feel I do. She said, well, yeah, they can do much more. I mean, there's, you know, why did she have to tell me that, right? And there is that built-in sense of, does the baby prefer them to us? It's just there. Can't help it.
And the rational side is the child probably needs both, right?
Oh, definitely.
Meaning
definitely
the younger and the older.
They need both, not because of the age, but because the more people who love you, the stronger you're going to be as a human being, as an adult. Having that kind of unconditional love all around you, that's going to be a healthy person.
Leslie Stahl's new book is Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting. We will continue our conversation with Leslie Stahl after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Leslie Stahl is our guest this morning. Her new book is Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting. Leslie Stahl has been a 60 Minutes correspondent since 1991. This season marks her 25th on the broadcast. Before joining 60 Minutes, she served as CBS News White House correspondent during the Carter, Reagan, and George H.W. Bush presidencies. She also hosted Face the Nation from 1983 to 1991, and it is a delight to have her with us this morning. Do you think about, I know you do, I mean, you write about this, of the impact that that amazing career that I just read about had on your parenting of your daughter and what you learned from that experience that impact how you grandparent?
I think how I grandparent is innate. I don't think it has any relation to how we parent. I think it just wells up in us that we love them, and anything they want, they can get out of us. So I don't think there is a relation in the sense of how I behave with my grandchildren. But I did miss a lot of my own child's life when she was young. There were soccer games I didn't get to. She played football. Can you believe it? I didn't get to all her football games. She was interested in theater. I didn't get to all her plays. And that weighs on me, and as I think it would any mother who works and has to travel, as I did. So there is that in the background. But honestly, I think to be a grandparent is to be swept along. There's nothing conscious, and you're constantly surprised at your own feelings and your own actions. Somebody said this morning to me, and it was so true of me, he said, you know, my parents would never take us to Disneyland. Mm-hmm. They would not go. They didn't want to go. They wanted no part of it. It sounded horrible. Lines, not going to do it. The grandchildren said, let's go to Disneyland. And the grandparents said, we're there. And off they went. And that's me. And you look at yourself and say, what? But there it is.
But you're also in a different place in your career where you can do that now if you want to.
Yes, but I never wanted to go to Disneyland. Ever. And I'm there. I hated the park. Oh my gosh, I just never wanted to go to the parks. Pushing that damn swing, I tell you, drove me crazy. And I would do it, but oh God, it was a real chore. I am in that park with those little ones, like pushing whatever they want, you know.
So I understand your point completely, but if I were to ask you, if CBS came to you and said, we want you to be White House correspondent again, and we want you to be with that president every moment, and that took away your time, would you take it?
No, I would not take it.
Because it would take away that
yes.
time.
Yes, yes. But I'm wiser, and I'm mellower, and I know more. I know more. Mm. Although I don't regret anything. I don't.
You also make the point in the book, and I... not to put words in your mouth, but I assume that this has something to do with that lack of regret, is that with your husband. You had a great team.
My husband raised my daughter, and he was a gifted parent. And one of his secrets to being a gifted parent was to back off. If I had stayed home and devoted myself to raising this child, she would be so neurotic. It would be such a mess. And, you know, she's level-headed. She's even-tempered. And she had a parent that was there but not encroaching, not a helicopter grandparent. And she's doing great in life. So I always tell her this. I don't know if she buys it. The best thing that ever happened to you was that I worked. And she'll tell you that. If she were in the room, she'd say, that's right. That's true.
I have only been in journalism for 30 years. And
only 30.
Only 30. But I haven't covered to the level, of course, that you have. But have you ever seen anything like this?
Never. I've never seen anything like this. And you know what? You don't have to say anything more. And everybody knows, everybody listening knows exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
I have never seen anything like this. Although I have covered elections where the person who won, I never expected to win. For example, Ronald Reagan. When that campaign started, I thought, and so did everybody else around me, that he was too conservative for the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he began to gain traction, it was a surprise. But, I mean, he never, he didn't come anywhere close to even the same continent as Trump is and how he campaigned. He campaigned with a smile. He campaigned with wit. He campaigned with great optimism about the country. And he just won people's hearts is what happened. This is another animal completely.
There was also a decorum.
Decorum.
That
exactly
seems to be completely
gone.
Lost.
Yep.
And my question is, do we reset and get back to that next election cycle, or have we now opened the floodgates?
Well, what happens when and if he loses? What happens? What do we say? Do we say that he lost because his tongue was out of control? Do we say the public rejected that kind of campaigning? I don't know. And if he wins, then of course there's no reining it back in. And you know, sometimes I think, oh well, Leslie, you're getting old. You know, don't think it's so over the top. But I'm hearing it from my daughter. I'm hearing it from even younger people, millennials. So it'll depend, I think, on if he loses, if Trump loses, what the so-called obituaries will say. Why did he lose?
Mm.
And if the polls show that the public just thought he was too over the top, then yes, I think we can rein it back in.
And you can even say that it's an amazing election year just looking at the Democratic side with Hillary Clinton, her second run for the White House, and having a much more difficult time than anyone would have expected.
Well, she had a pretty difficult time last time, having lost.
Right, right.
Well, don't forget that she's a grandmother. Not that I want to get back to the book. What I want to say about her being a grandmother is that, and I discovered this in the course of working on this book, that the public will accept an older woman and a grandmother more than they would accept a younger woman. And that her being a grandmother infuses her with a certain kind of authority.
Mm.
And I keep thinking, and it hasn't happened, and there's a whole book in that, that kind of image, the image of a grandmother, which is extremely positive, is going to rub off and begin to affect the way people see her. It hasn't, but it should. And why hasn't it is an interesting question.
Because even when she became a grandparent, there were questions as to, well, will she want to even run, or is she just going to want to be a grandparent?
Well, you know, I did. I don't want to stop working, so I don't find that a credible question.
Right.
Yeah. But I did. I joined Frank Luntz, who was a Republican pollster, when he went off to do a focus group in New Hampshire. This was over a year ago. Scott Walker was the number one choice of everybody in his focus group at that point. And Trump wasn't even on the radar screen. But I went, and he allowed me to ask some questions. And I asked, what word comes to mind when I say grandmother? And oh my gosh, the words were happy, unconditional love, cozy, warm. And then Frank asked what one word comes to mind when I say Hillary. And they were horrible words like dishonest, liar, cold. And then I got up and asked again, do you think her being a grandmother is going to soften her image? These were Republicans. And many of them, not all of them, but many of them said, yeah, they thought it would. But it hasn't. And so it's interesting to me. Why hasn't it?
Does the gray hair of Bernie Sanders help? And I ask that as a serious question.
No, it is a serious question. Not as much.
Also a grandfather, we should know.
They're all grandfathers. Trump's a grandfather, too. I don't think his gray hair helps him as much as Hillary being a grandmother should help her. Because grandfathers have been running for president and being president forever.
Right.
So it's not an unusual thing, and no one ever mentions it. I mean, you really have to strain to see that Bernie Sanders is a grandfather. Whereas it's one of the first things you think about with Hillary, and that would be true of any other woman. You know, Elizabeth Warren is a grandmother.
Yes.
That's why I'm saying that there is some sense of strength that comes with that. There is. An acceptance, not just strength.
When you think of this time, and I guess I'm curious as to how much of this is gender, and that the difficulty has to do with being a woman, or is it being Hillary Clinton?
Right. Being Hillary Clinton. Yeah. It's being Hillary Clinton. And some of the less than flattering adjectives that came up in the Republican focus group comes up in focus groups of Democrats, saying that she's not trustworthy, she's not honest. You see that a lot. And when I say I'm surprised that she hasn't worked on that, you know, specifically to overcome that image, because those are damaging adjectives to her becoming president. You want to trust your president, my goodness.
I read an article with you and Cokie Roberts, your good friend Cokie Roberts.
Yeah, she's my good friend.
And you all would have lunches in the 70s when you were all just starting out. And it was you and Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, Dottie Lynch, Kathy Weiler, Ann Smith, and Patricia O'Brien. First of all, man, to be a fly on that wall.
You would enjoy it because we talked a lot about men. We talked a lot about it.
But at that time, you needed that.
Yes. There weren't very many women around in the 70s. Affirmative action came in the very early 70s. We had the women's rights movement was churning, but affirmative action really was what brought women into the workforce, into the white-collar workforce, of course. And there we were, each one of us, the only woman in our different organizations. And we desperately needed the company of other women because we were spending all day with men and listening to what they wanted to talk about, which was sports, you know. How did the Redskins do? So forth. We were in Washington. And so we just craved the company of other women. And we had lunch once a month, and no one ever missed those lunches. They were really important to us. And we talked about very serious things, but we also talked about what you would call girly things. You know, where'd you get that nail polish? Where did you get your hair done? I mean, silly things, but the kind of comfortableness that none of us was feeling in the office. Now, that's changed. I work at 60 Minutes. I mean, it's not quite 50%, but there are a lot of women producers at 60 Minutes, and more women are getting on the air at 60 Minutes. So it's more comfortable at work now.
You talk about that in the book. Of when you first started, they were doing a documentary on 60 Minutes, and they asked you about what you thought about being in this pantheon of greatness and how you felt of being with Mike Wallace.
Being the young girl. Yeah, yeah.
Marlee Schaefer.
I so resented that. I mean, it's all these years, it's 25 years later, and I still go back there in my mind, and I the old resentment comes in. Because, you know, for in terms of credentials, I certainly had the credentials. It wasn't as if on paper I didn't belong there. But clearly the documentarians thought, young girl coming in, boy, she must be in heaven, which I was. I was totally in heaven. But
you also say that you were always determined not to cry sexism. That was important for you then, and is that still important to you now?
Yes.
And I'll even ask it in the context of the question earlier about Hillary Clinton.
Well, first going back to me, I believed and still believe that CBS hired me to succeed. They didn't hire me to fail. And if I was failing for whatever reason, it was probably because I wasn't doing a good job. And so what did I have to do better? What did I have to work on to improve? There was sexism. There's no question about it. But I decided that if I was, and a lot of women have done this, most women do this, what do I have to do to be so good they can't ignore me? They'll learn to appreciate me. And that's why women worked harder, still do, by the way, and put in more hours. But you know something, if you love what you're doing, which I always have as a journalist, it never really did seem like work. But I thought that attributing it as if I were a victim of something just was not going to help me survive in the profession, which is what I always wanted to do.
For those of us who enjoy your reports on 60 Minutes and all of the work that you do, I assume your mantra is to keep doing that until it's not fun anymore.
Or until they kick me off the air. But, you know, Mike worked till he was in his 90s,
yeah. And
so did Andy. That's kind of in the back of my mind, although I think I'll stop long before then, I think.
You think?
I think.
The name of the new book is Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting, and it's published by Blue Rider Press. Leslie Stahl, what a great honor and pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
So fun, Joe. Really, really wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting, as published by Blue Rider Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.